Welcome to Author Stories, the podcast where we talk to the best writers in the industry and discuss writing and the creative process. Whether you are a writer, a reader, or both, we hope you'll find something here that makes you love books and the writers that create them. You can find archives of all of the great conversations I've had with authors over the years at hankgarner.com. Take some time and browse around there. I'm sure you'll find a new author to love, find inspiration for your own creative life, and find a new story to get lost in. Let's thank some sponsors who make the show possible. No Good Deed, book one of the Mark Taylor psychological thriller series by M.P. McDonald, is free on Amazon.com. Seeing the future comes at a price. What price would you be willing to pay to save thousands of lives? Mark Taylor knows his actions scream guilty, but he was only trying to stop the horrible terrorist attack. Instead of a thank you, the government labels him an enemy combatant and throws him in the brig with no rights, no trial, and no way to prove his innocence. He learns firsthand that the CIA can do anything they want to him, anything at all. Mark's just a regular guy, a photographer, who finds himself in an extraordinary situation when an antique camera he buys at a dusty Afghanistan bazaar produces photographs of future tragedies, tragedies he's driven to prevent. His frantic warnings about September 11th are ignored, but put him in the government crosshairs when he learns what being labeled an enemy combatant really means. Download this intense and gripping thriller now, free on Amazon. No Good Deed, book one of the Mark Taylor psychological thriller series by M.P. McDonald. As the Crow Flies, Enter Haddon Wood, book one by Risa Walker and Caleb Ansell. From Risa Walker, the award-winning author of the best-selling Kronos Files, and debut author Caleb Ansell, comes a chilling story of altered reality and psychological terror. Chase Ray sits perfectly still, his thumbs traveling across the screen of the broken computer tablet, stuck in the nexus between two worlds. Haddon Wood isn't real. It can't be. Another world, another reality, hovers just beyond his reach. He can see it sometimes. He can almost touch it. In that world, things are in balance. The dead stay dead and the creature feature remains safely on the screen. That world isn't a patchwork quilt of every scary book or movie he's seen. In that world, the nightmares generally end when you open your eyes and people don't glitch in and out of existence. Chase is determined to return to that world, although he's a bit worried that the only way out is through the noose that seems to lurk around every corner. He needs allies to get back home. But how do you choose your team when you can't tell who's real? As the Crow Flies, Enter Haddon Wood, Book 1 by Risa Walker and Caleb Ansell. We're so happy to have our friend Crystal Pico Watanabe as a sponsor of the show. Crystal is one of the best editors in the business, and she has just debuted a new service that I think you'll absolutely love and will help you to up your writing game. Pico's School of Wordcraft and Editing has just debuted, and the first course is called Properly Punctuating Dialogue. It's a mini course and can be completed in just about 20 minutes. It covers the basics of dialogue punctuation. Authors can get access to the new school and the course for free by signing up for Crystal's author newsletter, Notes from Pico. Go to picoshouse.com/newsletters, that's PIKKOSHOUSE.com/newsletters. More in-depth courses will be added in 2020. Make sure you don't miss a thing. picoshouse.com/newsletters. Unwilling Souls by Gregory D. Little. Books 1 and 2 are only 99 cents for a limited time. The gods are rightfully imprisoned, and Cess intends to keep them that way. But her terrorist father has other plans. Gregory D. Little's Unwilling Souls is a pulse-pounding chase through an epic fantasy world of adventure, sinister conspiracy, and a magical industrial revolution fueled by harvested human souls. Cess is the daughter of powerful parents who would very much like to kill one another and who therefore pretends she doesn't exist. An apprentice jailer of the gods, Cess spends her days learning to forge the tools needed to maintain the gods' prison. When her terrorist father attacks the prison on her 16th birthday, Cess is forced to flee after the secret of her parentage is revealed. Suddenly on the wrong side of the law, Cess realizes the very father who abandoned her may be the only one who can protect her. But some secrets are darker than parentage. On her way to find her father, Cess will uncover truths about her family and herself that will shatter her understanding of the world and risk the return of the gods themselves. Unwilling Souls and its sequel, Ungrateful God, are on sale now for only 99 cents. The third book of the series is coming early next year, so now is the perfect time to get up to speed. Unwilling Souls by Gregory D. Little. Books 1 and 2, only 99 cents for a limited time. Well, thanks for joining me again for the Author Stories Podcast, where I bring you the story behind the stories and the storytellers. Today, I'm really excited to have John Waterman on the show with me today. He has a fantastic new book. It's from National Geographic. It's the Atlas of the National Parks. Let me tell you what, John, when I got this thing in the mail, I thought that our precious mail delivery lady was going to have a herniated disc or something. This thing is massive and it's gorgeous.
Well, it's funny you mention that because I do have a herniated disc, and now I can't pick up the two cases waiting for me that will be delivered tonight.
Oh, man.
Yeah, so it's a hefty affair and really, more importantly, a labor of love.
Well, it definitely exudes that. Let me just put it that way. But before we talk about the book, though, John, we begin each show with the same question, and that question is, what is your first memory of wanting to be a writer or storyteller?
My first memories, I would have to say that I was influenced greatly by a work of science fiction that made me love reading. And it was my love of reading that made me want to become a storyteller. I wanted to tell it as eloquently and with as much imagination as Frank Herbert brought to Dune, which happens to be the novel that sort of captivated me in a way that sent me on a course of reading for the rest of my life. And I believe that most writers are first readers before they can become storytellers. And so I would have to say, oddly enough, even though I have nothing to do with science fiction as a writer and don't read much science fiction today, that's what engaged my imagination.
Well, pardon the Dune pun, but I think Frank Herbert has been a gateway drug for a lot of readers and writers through the years.
Yeah. Oh, wonderful. I mean, just bringing that up makes me want to go back and revisit the work.
Yes, yes.
And that's a perfect segue to our national parks, like Great Sand Dunes National Park.
Exactly. Tell me where this book came from. You've been a photographer and a writer for quite a while, haven't you?
I have, yeah. I published my first book in 1983, and it was actually a national park project where I worked as a ranger in Denali National Park. I was performing a lot of rescues, and I was perplexed and challenged by the number of needless accidents and deaths that I was involved in. So I wrote a book, which is still in print, almost four decades later, called Surviving Denali. And I did it while I was working for the Park Service. I had my own researcher, and that book is designed to reduce deaths and accidents on North America's highest peak, which happens to be Plum in the center of Denali National Park. That was my first book, but I wanted to be a writer for a long time before 1983 and published magazine articles, beginning with an Explorer Scout magazine and eventually graduating to stories adventure-type journals.
The book focuses on the national parks here in the United States. I think a lot of people don't realize the treasures that we have accessible to nearly all of us, no matter where in the country you are. When you think about national parks, there are a couple that kind of come to the forefront of just about everyone's mind: Yellowstone and a couple of others. And but you know, one thing as you start flipping through this book is that we have national parks everywhere, and they all have a unique flavor and highlight something special about that part of the country. Can you give us just a brief history of the national parks, our National Park Service, and how we got to have these national treasures?
Well, you know, you mentioned Yellowstone, which is, you know, officially the first national park established in 1872, and the most iconic and well-known park in the world, really. But there was a parcel of land set aside decades earlier, in 1832, and in the middle of Arkansas, Hot Springs, and later, long after Yellowstone was established, they made it Hot Springs National Park. So the history of these parks really extends back into our democracy. And it wasn't until 1916, many of these lands had been set aside, including Yosemite, that the National Park Service was created in 1916. And the mandate was, among many things, to make these parks accessible to all, and of course to preserve them for future generations and in their intact form. And so from there, there was an interesting and very close collaboration, even preceding the National Park Service creation, with the National Geographic Society. In fact, the National Geographic Society lobbied heavily to create the Park Service. And once it was created, then in many instances, such as in Denali National Park, originally named McKinley National Park, they printed a special edition of the magazine and gave one to each member of Congress in order to get them to vote in the area as a national park, which they did in the year 1917. And so other parks followed, and eventually there are other agencies, often railroads, advocating for national parks like Glacier. And they were put into place usually by Congress through often preceded by extensive lobbying, and sometimes by presidents through executive orders. And eventually, the units within the Park Service system tallied to today 419, and that includes battlefields and monuments and even buildings, and national seashores and recreation areas. And among those 419 are 61 of the inviolate crown jewels national parks. And that's what this book is about, the 61 crown jewels, the Atlas of the National Parks. It's never been done before because it is an atlas that has extensive maps with it, some traditionally done as the Park Service did them, but some very creative and compelling as well.
Well, and you said it's an atlas, and it definitely is. I'm sitting here flipping through the book, and not only do we have you know, information about the history of that park, we've got detailed maps, we've got beautiful photographs like you can only get from National Geographic. I mean, it's a compendium, everything that you need to know about visiting that park, about there's information there to pique your interest about ones that you've never been to. How did this project, I mean, I can only imagine what it took to pull a book like this off, but how did this get started, and how did you get involved with it?
Well, to go back, I have a lifelong passion for wilderness, for nature, and so naturally that brought me into the parks repeatedly, just as an adventurer, as a nature lover, to look at wildlife, to challenge myself. And eventually I worked as a backcountry ranger in Rocky Mountain National Park, and then a rescue mountaineering ranger in Denali National Park. So I have not only developed an affinity, but I have an intimacy with many of these parks. So I was asked a couple of years ago if I would like to write the Atlas for National Parks. And I jumped at the idea. I was flattered and honored. The extensive research and writing began, and I did nothing else for a year and a half. But fortunately, the substantive research, I like to think, is the time, 40 years worth or more, of having wandered and explored national parks. Now, I haven't been to all of them. And so therein, one of the joys of doing this book, there are places now I want to go to more than ever, like Dry Tortugas or Isle Royale, both places, Michigan and Florida, that you can only get to by lengthy boat rides, some of the least visited parks in the lower 48. So again, it was a tremendous labor of love.
The book really highlights superlatives, things that really make these places shine. Could you share a few of those? That maybe things that people are not even aware of.
Yeah, you know, these things are in my head because I've been to many of them, and you know, there is the, for instance, the extremes of Death Valley National Park with the world's hottest temperature recorded several decades ago of 134 degrees, or that same park is the lowest point in North America. It's more than a couple hundred feet below sea level. And then I've already mentioned the tallest peak in North America found in Denali National Park. It just runs the gambit. You can go to the other coast and find Acadia National Park. It's the first place that you can see the sunrise in the U.S. Or Mammoth Caves in Kentucky, where there are over 400 miles of passageways and caves. That makes it the world's greatest cave system that we know of. And on it goes. It would take a couple of lifetimes to really do justice to exploring these parks.
It really is incredible. I'm sorry, go ahead.
It would take a couple of lifetimes not only to explore them, but to really get to know them.
Yeah. What is really astounding is when you really start looking through the book, you know, I live in the American Southeast, and so a trip to a place like Yellowstone or, you know, somewhere out west is going to be, you know, a once or twice in a lifetime trip, you know, for someone with a family, probably, if you get that. But there are places all over the country that are easily accessible to most of us. And I think people don't realize just how much we have very near to us. How important is it for us to get the word out that we do have all these resources? Do you feel like that it's that's underappreciated, in that we don't give enough information out there to help people find these places?
Well, I'm glad you're asking that question. I think that in one sense the information's out there, in that the parks are being loved to no end.
Yeah.
They're several years running. There have been over 330 million people visiting these 419
wow.
different park units. That's greater than the population of the whole U.S.
Right.
And so imagine the routine maintenance that has to be done on the roads, let alone the trails or toilets and trash barrels. And then, in my mind, the more important things are the preservation of the natural resources, the flora and the fauna and the natural wonders of the park. So the information that I think that we need to get out there now is we've celebrated the parks. In 2016, that was the 100-year centennial of the Park Service's creation, and that's what really brought the crowds to the national parks. So to answer your question, the information we need to get out there is exactly what I've done with this atlas, because I realized that not only as I delved deeper into the research, not only did I need to celebrate them, but I had to present some of the information that would allow us to protect them. And some of the issues that are now confronting national parks are grave indeed. And that includes, in many places, for instance, some of the worst air pollution in all the national parks is in the 4 or 5 California national parks. The ground level ozone is actually not only hazardous to human health for more than 60 days a year, but it's affecting the fauna and flora within these parks. Or we have invasive species, which are a scourge throughout the park. And by invasive species, I mean animals and plants that have come in from other places and have no natural predators, such as the Burmese python, which could be number is in the tens of thousands in Everglades National Park. And it's rapidly, that species is rapidly squeezing to death, literally the smaller mammalia of natural mammalia of Everglades National Park. Or more seriously in that park, for instance, we have issues related to fresh water. The Everglades is seriously depleted of fresh water that created this marvelous marshlands. And then we have sea level rise that's encroaching from the south while there's not enough fresh water coming from the north, which has been diverted to the metro areas. So as you can tell, I could go on and on about some of these issues. And the solutions, well, they're not simple solutions, but one of the places to start involve proper funding for these parks. And this administration has proposed a massive budget cut for next year's nearly $500 million of budget cuts. And the parks are already in deficit in terms of just routine maintenance. Depending on which park you visit, some of these parks, Everglades, are really I tackle these. I'm while celebrating the wonder at the same time. I think it's important that National Geographic has a longstanding legacy of paying attention to things like this.
One of my family's favorite national parks is the Great Smoky Mountain National Park, and it's just about 6 hours drive from where we live. And we actually went twice this year, once in the spring and once in the fall. And it's such a massive park and so much to do there, so much natural beauty. And it, as you're driving through there, you really notice the care that goes into maintaining, like you said, all of the trails and the roads and everything to just make it perfectly accessible for, you know, someone like me to just show up and enjoy. What does it take staff wise at these places to keep these places pristine the way we enjoy them?
Well, it's a great question for that particular park, because that happens to be the most popular park of them all. By twice, more than twice the second most popular park, Grand Canyon. There are over 11 million people a year that visit Great Smoky Mountains National Park. So the maintenance, you know, just the keeping the roads intact, which is essential when you have that those kinds of millions of throngs coming through the park. And the fact that your visit showed you a well-kept, relatively manicured place speaks to the job that the Park Service is doing. But it is a tough mission, and that park would be seriously hurting next year if this park budget is cut as has been proposed. And what does it take? Well, typically the maintenance crews in most of our national parks, particularly popular ones with roadways like Smoky, there are massive road crews and people that tend to the everyday kinds of things you wouldn't normally associate with national parks, like just cleaning the toilets and emptying the trash. And these are jobs that have to be done. But at the same time, we can't neglect what is known as the resource management, which is actually making sure that the incredible biodiversity and plant life of Great Smoky Mountains National Park is cared for. And for instance, how do we stop the poachers? There's a tremendous amount of poaching of plants from the national park there. So as you can imagine, with a park that's got that much attention, it's also being loved to death. And the rangers are seriously challenged.
Yeah, yeah. Well, we all need to be in communication with our representatives that if we love these places like we do, that we need to put our dollars where our heart is, for sure.
Well, I would like, since you've asked, I appreciate that. I would like to call your attention to an op-ed that I had just finished writing for the New York Times, which will appear in the Sunday op-ed page, speaking to these very issues, to try to bring attention to people that we need to start paying more attention to our parks, the care that they need.
I'll try to link that in the show notes of this episode so that everyone can go check it out. I think that would be great.
Well, thank you.
Yeah. The book highlights the story of Maine's Acadia National Park. Can you tell us about the carriage road there that has then gone on to set new standards and inspire other things going on?
Yeah, you know, that's a great question too, because a lot of people don't know that the roadways of the national parks, I think, are taken for granted. And Acadia is an example of, sort of immaculate architectural attention to roads. And many of these roads are actually built for horse and cart, horse and buggy, preceding the automobile. And those roads were stone quarried, and really it was the brainchild of one of the Rockefellers to build those roads. And when you go there, what you see are roads unlike roads anywhere else. And you see them in several other national parks, but unlike most roadways, not only are these you see the work of masons. It took years for them to build these roads, hand hewn in some places. They have a harmony with the surrounding landscape. They don't cut through things. They contour around, and of course, harmoniously provide many viewpoints and pullouts. And some of the older carriage roads are actually closed to automobile traffic, and they do have shuttle buses now in Acadia too, to limit traffic jams. But again, it's easy to overlook the roadways for the trees there. There's a great deal of thought and care, and a lot of this had to do in other parks, such as Rocky Mountain. Depending on when the parks were created, there was a time when automobiles became quite popular, and every American had to have a car. And this, in more than half dozen instances, this coincided with the creation of national parks. So great care was taken in roads for the automobile. For instance, in Rocky Mountain National Park, where I live in Colorado, there's the highest continuous paved roadway right over the Continental Divide at 12,000 feet. That is for those touring parks and their automobiles is a major attraction. But now that I've mentioned that what is often taken for granted, I hasten to add that it's essential that people park those cars and get out of the car and get off into the backcountry and smell the flowers and breathe in the forest, climb the mountains and get their good tidings, as John Muir said. That's why these parks were created.
Well, the book details all sorts of things that I never knew, and I'll spend many, many hours going through this book and enjoying it. But things like the 1.9 billion-year-old volcanic strata that lies at the bottom of the Grand Canyon, the largest tree, the highest waterfall, the deepest lake, all of this kind of stuff. And, I'm just making a dream list of places that I want to visit. But before we go, John, tell us what your favorite park is. Do you have one that you go to over and over again or has special meaning for you?
Yes, it's the Denali National Park. By far, in a way, is my favorite national park, probably because I've spent the most time there. But the time that I spent there also was quite diverse, from being chased by grizzly bears and chasing grizzly bears with resource management crews to get collars on them, and or climbing North America's highest peak, or walking for days at a time without seeing another human being, and raging rivers and as much ice as you can ever imagine, although there are thinning glaciers there in Denali National Park. The Alaska range that the park encompasses is so massive that it creates its own weather. So far and away, it's my favorite park, whether you go to climb the highest mountain or simply try to get a glimpse of it. It's a stunning place filled with wildlife.
Well, I love it. The new book is National Geographic's Atlas of the National Parks. John Waterman, this has been so much fun. I love the work that you're doing. We're going to put a link to it in the show notes. Is there a place where people can find you online to follow along with all the work that you do?
Yeah, jonathanwaterman.com is my website. Google my name and you'll find my work here, there, and everywhere from over the decades. I'm excited about the book. It just came out this week, and I bought multiple copies. It's the perfect holiday gift.
Absolutely. Absolutely. John, thank you so much for taking time to come on the show today and sharing this national treasure with us.
All right. It's my pleasure. Thank you.
Mather steepled his hands. You asked to join us once. Hedwig leaned forward, eagerly. The appointed. Does that appeal?
Yes.
Do you even know what we do? My grandmother used to say that you control the world. That's not far off. But why? To what end?
I don't know. Power?
Pour me a bourbon. Mather reached into his briefcase and produced a file folder. I want to tell you one story. Have you ever heard of Centralia, Pennsylvania?
No.
He produced a photo for Hedwig's inspection. Spring of 1962. A pretty little town, wasn't it? Whitewash and ticky-tacky. Pastel housewives and perfect lawns. A mining community, mostly. Coal. He turned over a second photo. A lovely young woman. There was a single witch in Centralia named Anna Lively. Anna had a green thumb. She could make her garden grow, whisper to a flower, and send it shooting from the ground like that. Just lovely. But she was discovered. That spring, a boy named Bobby Avery received a Bell and Howell Zoomatic movie camera for his 11th birthday. Bobby amused himself by filming his neighbors, sometimes without their knowledge, through windows and over garden fences. 12 seconds of film. Just a girl and her garden patch and one swiftly blooming rose. It killed the town. Bobby showed it to his friends. Children believe readily. Bobby was the first to die. Parents looked into it, watched the film themselves, and they began to die. Anna disappeared. Perhaps they attacked her, perhaps she escaped. But even in her absence, knowledge of a true witch was running wild through the population, as if Anna had beckoned it herself to grow verdant and spread. The great curse had killed 64 Centralians by the 1st of June. The footage was offered to a national news organization. That was the precipice. It might have been shown in prime time, between Leave It to Beaver and My Three Sons. We came very close to another worldwide calamity, but we were fortunate. One of our own was in place at the network. He alerted his superiors, and they ended the situation. Do you know how?
I'm afraid to ask.
Mather laid down another photo.
This is Centralia today.
It was an aerial view of a forest. Endless trees and underbrush cut through by lanes of pavement. Just a maze of cracking asphalt, like the foundations of Sodom, ripped bare by the wrath of God. Only a cemetery remained, on a hill overlooking the former town. A white marble angel stood among the graves, grieving for the ruins below, like Lot's wife, turned to salt.
You destroyed the whole town?
Not I. This was well before my time, but yes. Just as you'd cauterize a wound to stop a patient from bleeding to death. We blamed it on an uncontrollable mine fire deep below the earth. We actually set the coal burning in case someone investigated. It burns today. Touch any of those streets and you'll find them hot, the asphalt melting as if the town sat just above perdition. It's not something we're proud of, but it was necessary.
To save the world. Centralia, Pennsylvania, and everyone who'd seen that film had to be sacrificed.
Mather collected the photos. So, that is why the appointed exist, and that is what we do. Still want to join